Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com, where you will find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, let's dive into today's episode. My name is Adam Homey. I'm your host. I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. And we are going to cover a topic that is brought to us all the time by our listeners and people we interact with online. Specifically, how to build and scale multiple remote companies. I think what we've seen over the past several months is that those entrepreneurs who had something going on online had an advantage in some cases over those who did not have something going on online. And I think we've also seen over the past several months, and for better or worse, this is a lesson that has become very clear to some people very close to me, is that multiple streams of income are more critical than we even recognize, simply because you never know what's going to happen in the economy that could just wipe something out, like with a snap. And the way you're going to survive is when you have multiple different companies, multiple streams of revenue, so that if something happens to one stream, you still have three or four others going, or vice versa, or however you want to work that. To guide us through this topic today, we have somebody who we've been excited to have on Business Creators Radio for a while now, but given his very busy schedule, we've work to get him to spend some time with us. His name is Dave Schneider, and I'll just tell you a little bit about him. He has built and successfully exited two SaaS companies known as Ninja Outreach and LessChurn.io, and has grown his current marketing agency, Shortlist.io, to over $500K in revenue in its first year. Sounds good to me. So Dave Schneider, come on in. The weather's fine.
The weather is good. Thanks so much for having me, Adam.
All right. What we like to do here before we dive into what we're going to discuss today is take a step back. And our listeners know that we do this with every episode. And let's discover a little bit more about Dave Schneider, the man. And tell us a bit about your journey and what's brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Absolutely. Yeah, happy to do so. Well, I'll fast forward through more or less the first 20 years of my life.
I imagine,
you know, we have to kind of pick a starting point that's relevant. And essentially when I graduated college, I graduated with a math degree, and I went to work at Capital One as a business analyst. And I worked there for 2 years in DC with my girlfriend. And both of us were getting a little bored at work, as some listeners may relate to. And we decided we wanted to go travel. So we planned a year-long backpacking trip, and we quit our jobs. We saved up money, and we mapped out the route, and we went to Japan. And it was always our goal to start working online when we left, because we had savings that were going to allow us maybe to travel for 1 year or so. But we thought if we wanted to ever do more than that, we were going to need to find a way to make a little bit of money online to pad our runway. And so we started a travel blog. We started writing about our journeys, as many people do.
Right.
But we learned that there were advertisers who were interested in being on the website. And they were looking at things like the domain authority of the website as a means of getting a backlink from the site and sort of increasing their own rankings in the SERPs. And this is where I started to learn a little bit about websites and what metrics matter, and SEO and website design, and how to generate traffic and write a good blog article, and really the foundational skill sets of the things that I utilize a lot today and utilize a lot in my businesses. And so that one advertiser that originally reached out to us when we were in Japan very early on the trip offered to pay us like $300 for a couple links and a post really started the whole movement for us to start working online. And we basically grew that travel blog into a bit of a business, to be honest. fast forwarding a couple of years, we're still on the road because we had learned to make money from the travel blog. And I started a software business that was Ninja Outreach. And that was where I really started to build a remote team. The travel blog was me and my girlfriend, but the Ninja Outreach was me and a remote team. I had to learn where to find people and how to trust people that I didn't see every day in an office, and how to evaluate them on their skill set beyond maybe what they wrote in their pitch, but kind of, you know, really who they were. And so I built Ninja Outreach up with my partner, Mark, over 4 years to a team of 20 or so. And I exited from that in March of 2018. And then at this point, being pretty comfortable with remote teams and marketing in general, decided to start a marketing agency, which is shortlist.io. And that's what I've been working on now for the last 2 or so years. Again, with a remote team, it's been going very well.
Yeah. And I imagine that that was an interesting journey for you, is the whole thing about working with a remote team. So what would you say are some of the major lessons that you discovered about working with virtual teams and remote teams, things that you might not have anticipated when you first went into the business with Ninja Outreach?
Absolutely. There's so many different lessons that one learns by doing something that they don't know. Some of them good, some of them bad. And I want to kind of give a little bit of a mix of both of those. So, I mean, some of the first things that we learned was, or that I learned, was just that there's really great talent out there. It was my opinion that I had to do everything, and I had to sort of be the one writing the blog and doing even design on the website and customer service and all these things that I assumed, you know, other people maybe didn't have the skill set, or outside of America, for example, didn't have the level of English to be able to do it. And I've totally done a 180 on that. And even recently, even having worked with remote teams for years, there were still a few things that I held very close to my chest and saying, oh, well, only I can get on a sales call and close a deal for thousands of dollars with a potential client. You know, there's just a line to which an outsourced remote worker, you know, they're not going to be a good fit. And I've learned that's not the case either. I have people right now in Macedonia for our business development team and shortlist that can get on a call without me there at all and just take the customer through the journey completely. So you really have to learn to question, what are your assumptions based on, basically? If they're based on experience, that's different. You know, if you've had experience with different workers and things haven't gone your way, fair enough. But if they've just sort of, you just kind of show up one day and you have these inherent beliefs or biases, you should really question those. That's one of the bigger lessons that I've learned, one of the positive ones. On the flip side, one of the sort of, I guess, negative ones is, you know, that there is a difference, obviously, between a remote team and a team in an office in the way that they're able to work together and communicate with each other. And there are definitely hurdles. They're not insurmountable, but they are out there. You might deal with people on different time zones. You might deal with people who speak different native languages, who have different days off because holidays are different in their country. All of these different types of things, you know, people have different costs of living. And so maybe you hire people for a similar role, but the pay just doesn't really make sense in one context as it does in another. All these different types of things need to kind of be thought through. And there are, like I said, there are ways around it. I think we'll get into it in this call, some of the different tools and techniques and stuff that can help these hurdles, but they are definitely out there. It is not just the easiest thing to do.
In my work with organizations, for myself, dealing with virtual and remote teams, a recurring theme that comes up is asynchronicity, where you do not have people in the same time zone, in the same place, working in the same, and with even within the same flow in many cases. One of the things that I have discovered is very important, at least from my own perspective, and I cover this in my book, Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy, is the idea of creating dependencies. This is in the section of the book that's about making deadlines actually matter to people. Because as an entrepreneur and as a business leader yourself, Dave, I'm sure you have set many deadlines that just kind of pass by. Has that ever happened to you before?
No, that has never happened to me.
Never, never. Well, here's what I discovered it looks like from the perspective of somebody on a remote team, because I've managed them, I've been on them, and I've been both at the same time, is that unless something has a dependency, unless something else will happen or not happen, if something does or doesn't get done, it, you know, it's not a big deal. And this is another thing that we find under the conundrum of the startup. My solution for solving the startup conundrum is to go out there and get a customer to pay you to do something. Now suddenly all those meetings and planning sessions and retreats and PowerPoints about what our next 5 years are going to look like when we haven't made a dime yet, all that goes away, because now you actually have customers to serve and you're discovering real lessons in real time. All that being said is, if you, let's say that I was on your remote team and you assigned me a deadline, and I'm going to think, oh, that's cool. But what happens? I mean, is there somebody else who depends on me getting that done? Is there something maybe with a marketing campaign or something you're doing to close a deal or something you're doing to bring a $1 million project to fruition? If you want, at least from my perspective, to overcome one of the challenges of asynchronicity and get people to actually care about deadlines. In fact, that's actually the title of that subsection of my book, How to Get People to Actually Care About Deadlines in 2 Simple Steps. And the second one is creating dependencies. So that's just my view on it. And especially when you're in a startup mode, you may be setting goals and deadlines for things. And if it's your first rodeo or even your second or third rodeo, you may not yet even have the understanding of what's important or what's not important. That's just my view.
Yeah, I think your perspective is 100% correct. And I think it's almost a little bit of a respect issue as well. And the reason I say that is because it's one thing to give people deadlines. You can kind of, you know, if you're the boss, you can kind of just give deadlines however you want, right?
Right.
Like, technically. But to actually explain to somebody why that deadline is the way it is, that there is a purpose for the work, that there's a next step, I think that they're better off for it. That people like to know they're part of something bigger, that the stuff that they're working on has impact and meaning, and that there's sort of a next step for the work that they're going to do. And so I always, you know, I'll be honest, just, you know, you're never 100% at anything, right? And sometimes I kind of forget to give the full context and stuff like that. But to the extent that I can, I always try to give a deadline and then give some context with it as well about why we need it done when we need it.
Yeah, I think you actually, you're touching on another thing right there when it gets to communicating. And this is where team building really becomes a powerful tool and vessel for growing a business, particularly a remote business. After a while, once you've worked with somebody for a period of time, you've done some things together, you've had some successes together, you've even had some failures together, you develop sort of a shorthand where when one says something, the other knows what it means. It's like they can start to explain, the other says, yep, I know that song by heart. And once you have that in place, you can really get a lot of stuff done very quickly, but it can take a lot of time to develop that kind of shorthand.
Yeah, I work very closely with members of the team, and they've learned just how much I really love communication. I love it when somebody comes to me and says, hey, Dave, I just wanted to give you an update about the outreach campaign we're working on or something like that without me asking, because I, you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm asking something like, hey, how'd that call go? Or how are we doing on this report or something like that? And you know, it's normal, but it's a little tiresome, to be honest, to always sort of be asking for updates. I love people kind of come to me and say, hey, you know, I'm guessing you want to know what's going on, so I'm just going to go ahead and tell you. And so I do try to train the employees to know that that's the way I like to be communicated too. Perhaps that isn't the case for everybody. Some people are more of a door shut type of approach, and they don't necessarily want to be bothered. I would much rather be bothered because it allows me to not have to ask them later.
Yeah, so you have to decide whether you want the kitchen sink and the dirty dishes in it, or the dirty dishes and no place to wash them.
You got it.
Yeah. I have found that another thing that you might want to consider, and again, we're talking about real world stuff that might not necessarily be outlined step by step in the textbook, is the process of creating action habits. And there are different theories about how long it takes to create a habit. Some people say if you do something every day for 30 days, it becomes a habit. Some say it doesn't matter how often you do it, as long as you do it over a period of 90 days. Whatever. There are many different ways to create a habit. And I have found in the real world what can be effective is to set a policy and stick by it. Let me give you an example of what I mean. This is from one of my own client experiences where I manage logistics of how their teams work. Let's say that you have a process for setting up a live stream. You do a live stream every week to your fans and followers. So there's a process. You need to identify the topic. You need to put up maybe a landing page. You need to make sure that an email goes out to your list. You need to make sure that you have posts getting done. If you're using bot marketing, you got to make sure that happens. But none of that can begin until the person who's responsible for setting the topic, the description, and such for what that live stream is going to be about that week submits their information. So what I will do in that case is I will be an absolute stickler for that information. And I'll say, I don't care if the live stream is tomorrow morning and we've been asking six times. If we don't have that information, nobody's lifting a finger for anything. And if they don't submit the information properly the first time, to call them out on it immediately. Not like, you forgot, but like just to point out, or rather call out the process that something was missing. And this is going to sound how it's going to sound. And I've actually gotten this feedback. People have said, you know, we finally got good at just getting you the information we need because we didn't want to hear you bitch.
Yeah, I think then you and I have a very similar approach because I also can be a bitchy stickler, I guess is the way you describe it. I hope it's okay to use that word, but you broke the ice.
Let me tell you something about our show, and this happens frequently. We have listeners who tune in just to see if I'm going to go off on some hysterical rant.
Okay, good to know.
And so far, I've been pretty calm. You're a pretty placid guy here, so we may just have a quiet conversation. For our listeners and those who are tuning into Business Creators Radio Show and those who are going to various syndication networks to make sure you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you, what we ultimately want you guys to experience is it's like you're sitting in on a private mastermind session between myself and my guest, in this case, Dave Schneider. So if that's the experience we're delivering, then we're doing what we were supposed to do. So if it seems like this seems a little informal and we're just sort of yucking it up here a little bit, imagine having the opportunity to sit somewhere and observe a private mastermind between a couple of people who have been there and done that and are dropping morsels of life brilliance on you. That's what we want to have happen. David, proceed.
There we go. Yeah. Cheers on that explanation. So yeah. Just to finish that thought, firstly, you mentioned a couple of things that are sort of worth highlighting. Number one is, you know, what is the source of work of something that somebody's producing, because they may have to collect information from somebody else, right? And so making sure that information is done and delivered on time really kind of creates the domino effect about whether or not the end result is able to be finished on time. You know, half the time if somebody doesn't give me the report, it's not necessarily because they were late, but because somebody else was late giving them something. So you really have to kind of think about the source and making sure that everything is kind of got the appropriate deadlines. To help that along the way, I do like to have people set reminders, you know, when necessary. We are all human and we do forget things, and having a reminder if something is, monthly or weekly or something like that, that makes it, I think, a lot easier on the person to not have to consciously remember, but just a reminder kind of pings them. That said, you mentioned attention to detail and kind of being a stickler. And I think that's my approach as well about really, you know, I have a little bit of an OCD tendency. I'll be the first to kind of admit it. So if I have a sheet that I'm looking for someone, for example, the biz dev team to fill in, it can get a little embarrassing. I'll be honest. I like websites without hyphens at the end or backslashes or any stuff like that. I like everything to sort of be exactly looking the way that it does when I set it up myself. And so when I work with people in sort of a communal document like that, I'm always kind of a stickler about the details, about that things are exactly the way I've kind of set them up to be. And what I'm trying to do is kind of build the habit, because if somebody's paying attention to the very, very fine details, I feel like that just ingrains that habit extremely deeply in them, which is, because the important thing is that maybe not necessarily the details per se in terms of, does the website have a backslash at the end of it, but that the website is but that the sheet is actually filled out on time and stuff like that. But if you've got somebody focusing so deep on the details within that, they're definitely not going to forget the larger picture of what needs to be done.
Yeah. And going back to, we just don't want to hear him bitch again. I mean, that was feedback that was given to me. And it was meant in a jocular manner. It wasn't a criticism or anything like that. And when I heard it, I'm thinking, yes, this is actually working the way I want it to. So a way that I have articulated that with a couple of clients in real time is when it comes to that thing where we know it's something that happens on a regular basis, and we know that there are three or five specific pieces of data, fill in these blanks, get it to us, and then the rest of it will just happen. And when I don't get that stuff, or it's not delivered in a proper format, or it's incomplete, I'll say, once again, we are having five rounds of discussion about a routine process that should require no discussion.
Yeah.
And what I found every time I've used that approach is I might have to go through that once or twice, but what usually happens after I use that phrase is the response I'll get to it is actually the complete information, because now they're starting to get it and they're recognizing that the reason I'm starting by being such a stickler when it comes to a process is because I'm creating habits, action habits, so that things that are routine that really should not require any discussion or analysis at all, that we should be able to just get done. We get ourselves in the habit of supporting each other in such a way where we don't have to ask each other any questions to get it done.
Yeah, sometimes you have to beat a dead horse. And just, to touch back to earlier aspects of this conversation, talking to people about the larger picture, about the context, about why something needs to be done on time in a certain way, kind of allows you to be a bit of a stickler. But if you don't really give them that context, you're just going to be like, wow, he's just being a jerk.
Yeah. There's another thing I point out, and I mentioned this in my book, Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy. And I actually repeat this in two different places. It's the same subsection of a chapter, but I copy paste it at two different places because it's that important. And I challenge the business creator, the entrepreneur, the team leader to, in every way possible, look at what they're doing on a daily basis and ask this question: what would happen if we didn't do this at all?
Yeah, I think so many times the answer to that question is nothing at all,
exactly.
Right?
That's my point.
And those are exactly the types of things that, need to be sort of cut out. I mean, sometimes, we like to set 90-day plans at work it's sort of like a list of tasks that we like each department to kind of get done. It's their goal for the next 90 days. And then what I'll often do is we'll look back at the end of the quarter on kind of what was done and maybe what wasn't. And I'll kind of ask myself, whether or not that really was something that needed to be done, or whether I just thought that, hey, that would be a good thing to throw in the 90-day plan because of whatever.
Right. Now, the other thing that question can reveal is some of the things we've been discussing, or the dependencies and the consequences and impacts of not doing something. So that once we ask that question, what would happen if we didn't do this at all? And we see, oh yeah, this thing would happen, or that thing wouldn't happen. Now we begin to understand not only priorities, but also dependency impacts. And that builds a culture of accountability and mutual support.
Yeah, I love it. Love your approach.
Yeah, and let's just have a little bit of fun with something. Have you ever heard the one about why people cut the ends off a roast when they put it in the pan?
No, my wife does all the cooking.
Okay, so let me tell you about this. And this is a friend of mine that told me this. He said that he noticed that when his wife put a roast in the pan, she would always cut the ends off the roast before she put it in the pan. And he asked her why she did that. And she said, well, my mother told me that when you cut the ends off the roast, it allows the juices to get in, so it makes the roast much more delicious and tender and everything else. Well, then the guy went and asked his mother-in-law, and the mother-in-law said, well, you know, my mother taught me that when you cut off the ends of the roast, it allows the juices to sink in and it makes the roast more tender and delicious. And wouldn't you know it, his grandmother-in-law was still around. And so because he's really trying to get to the bottom of this, because he doesn't understand why they're cutting off the ends of the roast. So he went and asked his grandmother-in-law, and she said, well, you know, during the Depression, we couldn't afford a bigger pan. That's the only way we could make the roast fit.
Yeah, it's a good story.
The point being is that many permanent roles are long-ranging, permanent overreactions to a temporary one-time blip on the radar. So we get all these rules and regulations. We don't even know why they're there. And that's the reason they start to not even make sense. So when we ask that question, what would happen if we didn't do this at all? We can unsurface some of that. So what happens if you don't cut the ends off the roast? Well, really nothing. It's not going to really make a big difference, really. But then you start asking those whys, and you start going back through the chain of the history, and you find out that your wife's grandmother's family was poor during the Depression, and they couldn't afford a bigger pan.
Yeah.
And grandma told mother that, well, you know, honey, we're cutting off the ends because it's going to make it taste better, because she doesn't want to tell her little kid that they're too broke to afford a damn pan.
Yeah, a lot of so much of what we do or think, unfortunately, is based on very arbitrary things. And essentially, a lot of times when we build an organization and we start to set up processes in a way of doing things, they become kind of accepted as almost like, I'm not biblical, but almost like holy, you know. It's sort of, we do it this way because it's always been done this way. And sometimes there was a reason initially maybe to do it a certain way, but that reason is no longer relevant. And we're not questioning whether or not we should still be taking that approach. And if that approach is relevant with the current organization and team and vision and mission and all those different types of things. So you really do have to be kind of questioning, what you take as fact or sort of necessary.
One of the things that early on got me labeled unemployable within a corporate environment is the first time someone ever said to me, well, we've always done it that way. And I don't even know where this came from. It was just sort of its own volition, but I just blurted out. I said, yeah, and somehow you're still in business despite that.
That's a good one. I felt like this was going to go back to something that you said. I just felt like that it was, it was going to be related to a manner of speech.
Exactly. So here's one thing I'm curious about. What we're discussing here today, of course, is building and scaling multiple remote companies. Now, do you recommend the approach of doing them one at a time? Do you recommend the approach of doing two or more simultaneously? Or do you think that the answer to that question is it depends? And if so, what does it depend on?
Well, it probably depends, but I'll say what's worked for me, and that's always one at a time. I find it very difficult to kind of be juggling multiple projects at once successfully. I think that, most businesses need, they need some degree of processes and sort of oversight to be running smoothly. And I often find businesses kind of hit milestones and they kind of maybe plateau, for example. And so, for example, with Shortlist, I felt recently in the last two or so months, we were sort of like plateauing, we kind of had some up and down months, but we just weren't really breaking into new highs. And I felt, okay, this was a time when I need to kind of go into the business and really reevaluate how we approach, for example, business development and link building and the other services and departments that we have on our team. And I learned that, I thought that some of the things we were doing were suboptimal. And I went, you know, worked very closely with the team to sort of fix those and improve them. And now we're seeing, you know, really great results from that, right? Happy ending to that story. And essentially now they can kind of continue to do what they're doing for some amount of time, maybe some number of months. And then there's probably some other plateau around the corner. But now would be sort of the perfect time to allow them kind of to take the learnings and to run with it while I diverted focus to another business, for example. And so I think that for me, you know, working on one at a time and then kind of getting the business to some level of you know, underlying processes that are kind of governing it, where it doesn't maybe take as much of your time, allowing it to grow, that's an opportune time to maybe focus on something else. And then when you see that business is starting to maybe stagger, that's a good time to kind of come back in with a fresh head and look at how things are being done and what opportunities there are and kind of going back and forth.
Yeah, I had this discovery. This was actually a client of mine, happened last year. They got the bug to start a business to capitalize on the trend they saw in the marketplace. And it was an online business. It actually wasn't all that different from the business they were already in. It just served a different niche and rendered a different service. And they did a test pilot on it. They did a pilot program, which went, and looking at it retrospectively, they found out the reason why. It's because their primary business that they were already in needed a lot of work. And actually, by starting the second venture, it began to surface some of those issues, because now they began to see, without the same bandwidth to be able to assign to it and the same financial backing to be able to assign to it, its holes became gaping and glaring.
Yeah, and I've noticed that just looking at my own business as well, that, you know, often when I'm kind of just in it day to day, it can be sort of difficult to understand what's not, you know, right about it. But instead, you know, coming back to it after having taken a little bit of time off or had my focus somewhere else, I come in, I see things that are just obviously incorrect, that I never really kind of questioned at the time. And so that's why, for me, the recommendation isn't about trying to kind of simultaneously manage two things, but almost to kind of, you know, work with the left hand and then, okay, now I'm going to move over to the right.
Yeah. And I think that there is an interesting balance that we look for here. You've heard, or probably heard, that phrase from Sir Richard Branson, "Screw it, let's do it." I believe that was one of his book titles.
He's the guy
I know. I've read it too. And he's said many times that if you're given a great opportunity, say yes and then figure out how to do it. His words are slightly different, but that's the paraphrase. And to a degree, I believe there's validity to that. Because if you wait for absolute certainty in every decision, you're going to be waiting long past your own lifespan. Because absolute certainty, yeah, right. At the same time, I believe that if you go and do something that's too foolhardy and you say yes because Richard Branson said that, screw it, let's do it. Well, what if that wasn't something you were supposed to be doing? I have seen people go full hog, commit 6 and 7 digits of funding to business ventures that they had no business being in the first place, because they got so ingrained into screw it, let's do it, and just decided that they were going to be the next Richard Branson. Well, Richard Branson didn't get to be Richard Branson by, you know, through stupidity. I mean, he made a lot of bold moves, but they were calculated moves if you actually study his story, number one. And number two, nobody but Sir Richard Branson can be Sir Richard Branson. Dave Schneider can only be Dave Schneider. So is this something that Dave Schneider can do? Maybe the answer is yes. We don't know.
This is true. I mean, so much, I think, with entrepreneurs, there's a lot of, this element of risk taking, that entrepreneurs are sort of taking risk, and they are, but the risk, like you mentioned, are often a lot more calculated than one realizes. When I started Ninja Outreach, for example, years ago, I didn't start that from scratch. I wanted to start a software business, and I had some ideas, but I didn't have a developer. I didn't have any development skills of my own. And I connected with Mark on a podcast, and he had a friend, Paul, and they had this, you know, really basic product. You almost couldn't even call it an MVP. It was just kind of like just some little software thing. And they said, hey, what about we work on this together, the three of us, and we use this as kind of the starting platform for building Ninja RH. We'll build off of this. But because we've already put in all this work to kind of get to where it is, you know, we think that, you know, you should have to kind of buy in to be a part of it. And maybe, you know, I think something like 15 or 20 grand or something like that.
Yeah.
And obviously this is not six or seven figures, like you mentioned, it's 15, 20 grand. But at the time, being in my 20s, being a budget backpacker, having had a little bit of success with the travel blog, but by no means kind of swimming in coins like Scrooge McDuck, you know, it seemed like a lot of money at the time. And so I was like, well, you know, I'll think about it. And I kind of talked about it with my dad, and I said, well, so what's kind of the worst that happens, basically? You know, well, you're out, you know, 15, 20 grand or something like that. Which would be a shame, but it was not, you know, my entire net worth. And I still had my education, and I had a place at my house, and I had a lot of things I knew that I could fall back on if this thing didn't work out. And he said, well, what's the upside? The upside is that, you know, you build a nice software business. And I said, well, that sounds pretty good. And so we did it. And that was a screw it, let's do it type of thing, where it's like, well, you know, I think some people would have said, you know, heck no. They would have said, they would have tried to negotiate, hey, no, I don't want to pay 15, I'll pay 12 or something like that. And then it would have just kind of started with this animosity and arguments between the partners and stuff like that. But I said, hey, screw it, let's do it. Let's see what happens. At the end of the day, this is, you know, this is not going to be a major loss.
Well, here's a, and I'll keep this pithy. I invested in something 4 years ago, and I ended up putting about $5,000 into it, and the thing crashed and burned. I'm not going to get into the reasons why. I'm just going to say that the phrase crashed and burned has relevance to it in terms of how the business model went on the other end. I hold no animosities or anything like that, and I had done my due diligence research going into it, and it just didn't play out the way I thought it did. So, actually, it was $500 a month, and by the time I got to the point where I realized I needed to put out, I'd put in about $5,000. So on the one hand, I did diligence before getting started, but then I continued to monitor the situation, and I realized after 10 months that not only was this not going anywhere, I probably just lost my money. So at that point, I just cut it off. I said, I'm done. So sometimes that happens. Then you also have situations where, for example, you get another type of opportunity. I was invited in 2016, same year, to contribute a chapter to the book Journeys to Success, the Millennial Edition. It was $500 to buy in, and I had to submit a chapter of 3,500 words. Well, that's pretty low investment. Now, what was really good about it is I got involved in a community of writers. It led me to new opportunities to get involved with the community, and that I've even gotten two clients out of it. So to me, that $500 was money well spent. Now, in both cases, I took these things to my mastermind group, and they naturally said, well, no, don't do that. That's stupid. Now, they couldn't communicate to me that I shouldn't do these things because I didn't have the framework to understand it. Now, a lot of people in the room had gone through things like this and been burned by it one way or the other, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, everybody has their own view. Now, somebody else in this same mastermind group was approached to contribute a chapter of her own to one of the other Journeys to Success books, because that was an entire franchise. And everybody in the mastermind group said, no, don't do it. Now, this was 2 years after I'd done it, and I'd shown that it turned me into an international Amazon bestseller, and I got two great clients out of it. And I said, look, you can do this. It's $500. And I just, and here's a document for you. I just went to your blog. I pulled seven articles. I put them in this particular order, and your word count is 3385. So spend an hour or two and put a story on top of this. Here's your chapter. Done. And you'll probably get a client that's worth $5,000 out of it. So this is something that takes you an afternoon. You're in and out, and you'll probably get 10x ROI. But yeah, I would be leery of recommending somebody else to jump into something at a higher price point without at least having the framework to know that due diligence is an ongoing thing. What saved me and gave me the ability when I got to the 5,000 point and I realized the whole thing was going south, to cut my losses, is I kept doing due diligence on an ongoing basis. And I saw that things were trending in a direction which I hadn't originally anticipated, but it was not going in a direction that was sustainable. So I got out while the getting was good. And I think there's something to be said for that in business too. And I think that if more entrepreneurs and business creators had the confidence and the framework to be able to say, this seemed like a good idea at the time, I have no regrets, I stand by that decision, I would make it again if I had the same data and the same opportunity, it's just not heading where I thought it was. So now that I've tried it, now that I have screwed it and done it, I realize that this is not going to really pay off, so I'm going to cut my losses.
Yeah, I can cite numerous examples of times where I also had to cut my losses on different things. A recent one was a software we tried to launch at Shortlist. It was kind of an SEO tool like that. We had developed it internally for ourselves, and we thought, hey, why don't we try to commercialize it and put in a little extra dev work to kind of clean it up, and this will be a nice source of maybe revenue, maybe generate some leads for the link building and things like that. And then, you know, we worked on it for 6 or so months and kind of shopped it around, and honestly, people just weren't really that interested in it. You know, there was just a lot of SEO tools on the market, and they didn't need another one. And, you know, of course, hey, that was 20 grand or something like that of the agency's money. That, you know, hey, well, it's always a shame, obviously, to not be profitable in every endeavor that you take on. But thinking back at the thought process behind whether or not we, you know, this made sense and what the opportunity was. I don't regret it. I don't think it was dumb. And we had a limit on it, right? We could have continued to be spending 1, 2, 3 grand a month, just every month. And instead we said, okay, you know, this was the kind of the limit. This is what we set aside to kind of prove the concept. It didn't work out, and we're pulling the plug and we'll move on.
Just without having any details, just looking at this from the outside looking in, I see an asset that you have. You did invest X amount of money to build this software. Maybe there's somebody else who feels that they could make a go at it with that software. They're not good developers, but there's a good software, and maybe they're going to see a niche that you don't. You could sell the software. You could get part of your money back.
It's totally true. Yeah. You know, it is an asset. It does still exist. It does still work. We still use it internally. Now is not the time, and maybe it will never be the time. But like you said, you never really know what's going to kind of happen down the line.
I'm going to say something very candidly for our listeners. Last year, I told you earlier about a client who did a pilot program on something and thought, eh. Last year, I started a program called In Demand Expert, which was a podcast guest booking agency. I did a pilot program too. The program overall went pretty good. There were a lot of lessons learned. And then I put it on pause. And I'll tell you the reason why. I felt that I developed something really good. It had a lot of great services associated with it. But I decided that I wanted to go in a different direction than a lot of other agencies in the podcasting industry. And the timing wasn't right for what I wanted to do. So I have it all built and I have it all ready. And I'm just now moving forward with where I really want to go with it based on the experience of my research, studying the industry, predicting trends that I'm now starting to see come into play, and having the mechanism ready to go so that I can be the first to hit the market with it. I just looked at it and said, this is promising. This has a lot of juice.